Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. His name is Ryan from Neckong, New Jersey.
Hi, my name is Ryan McDonald. I'm an alcoholic. I've been to the grace of the loving God, strong sponsorship, an awesome home group, 12 steps of 12 traditions. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since October 2nd of 2004, and for that I'm as grateful as I know how to be today. You know, I was taught when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous by my sponsor to say those words because I can say that and then I can sit down. You know, because that was exactly what I needed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober, and if I managed to do those things, you know, come to a relationship with God, clean house, work with others, then I'm not going to go back out, and I've known that to be true. I was thinking on the way over here from New Jersey. I'm from the Working with Others group in Neckong, New Jersey. We meet on Thursdays and Sunday nights, Thursdays at 8 for an open speakers meeting in which we invite a speaker to share for the 45 minutes, and on Sunday nights for a closed discussion meeting in which we discuss the solution. You know, I was told I got plenty of problems, and so does everybody else. What I need to hear is I need to hear what the solution is. So if I'm going to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm going to share a problem, I'd better follow that up by a solution, because there might be somebody else in the room who has that same problem and may need my solution. So we talk about the solution, and I love that meeting. Now, those two meetings have been the core of my sobriety since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was thinking also when I came over tonight that, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I think about my day-to-day more than anything. I got up this morning a little bit later than I would have liked. It was one of those things where, did I not set the alarm last night? It was kind of running out the door. And one of the mainstays of my sobriety, every morning hitting my knees and asking God to direct my thoughts and actions for the day, I have to do that every day. And I'll tell you, this morning it was quick. It was God help me, and I was off, and sometimes that's all I need, because I wake up late, my mind's going a million miles a second, and I need some kind of stopgap in there, and God's that, so God help me, and I got running, I thought about my son as I was leaving the house. I have a 2-year-old son. I kissed my wife goodbye as I left, and I went off to my job, and those are all things that I have as a direct result of my active participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got here, my girlfriend at the time was ready to leave me. The prospects of a child were less than likely, and my job was in question as well. And it's because of being in AA that I get to enjoy those things today. So. Back to the beginning. I'm a military brat. My father's a retired Air Force captain. I've lived all over the Midwest, Oklahoma, North Dakota, Colorado, and finally landing in New Jersey. And I'll tell you, I don't know, care what you think about New Jersey. If you lived in North Dakota, you'd love New Jersey too. Stand on a can and see Winnipeg. It was really not a whole lot going on out there. And also, probably a good thing, not a whole lot of places to get into trouble. I can't say that I didn't, but it was difficult. I'm one of three boys. I have two brothers, one of the things I remember as a young man, I'm one of those guys that believes my alcoholism started long before I ever took the first drink. It was just waiting to get wet down. I remember being a very angry young man. My parents were both fairly busy and left us the three boys alone in the house quite often, and invariably there would be fights, and I would chase them out of the house with knives, lock the doors, and make sure they couldn't get back inside, and then when my mom came home, blame it all on them. If they hadn't been picking on me, if they hadn't been mean to me, if they hadn't done what they did, I wouldn't have had to do what I did. It was never a matter of being out of control or being just a psycho. It was all their fault. That kind of behavior persisted for quite some time. I used to always share when I first got when I first started speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. First off, my first drink of any consequence. I was 12 years old. We were at a holodome That's a Holiday Inn with a dome over the pool, very popular out west. So you can go swimming in it in the winter. We were a Hall of Dome, and my parents were tired, and they wanted us boys to go to sleep. So we were 12 and 14, and my parents, being average temperate drinkers, know the effect that alcohol has on them. So they said, well, we'll give each one of the boys a glass of wine, and they'll relax and they'll become tired and they'll want to go to bed. And it worked for my brothers. I had that glass of wine, and it was to have the effect on me that alcohol had on me until my last drink. It was like rocket fuel. Somebody lit the fuse and I was off to the races, running around like a chicken with my head cut off for the next 4 hours until I passed out. My parents were long asleep, and alcohol's had an effect on me. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me that we have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, I understood exactly what that meant. Because I always had an abnormal reaction to every drug I took. If it was booze, I got fired up. I was one of those motivated pot smokers. The first time I had caffeine, I fell asleep. My body does not process drugs in a normal fashion. And that's just, that's how it was. I also used to share when I first came here that there wasn't a lot of drinking in my childhood. Military family, the police on military bases carry M16s, and they're not to be trifled with. I was a fairly, like I said, fairly well behaved kid. I didn't do a whole lot of drinking. There was the occasions. One thing I always used to look forward to was my parents. At Thanksgiving or Christmas or New Year's, we'd get a glass of wine or a glass of champagne, whatever happened to be appropriate for that holiday. And I used to look forward to that. And I used to always ask for more. And that's to play out as we go along here. Let's see here, where am I at? when I was just getting out of, just in the middle of eighth grade year, my father was medically retired from the United States Air Force, and there was a lot of uncertainty about our future and about what we were going to do. We eventually ended up in, like I said, in New Jersey. My father got a good position and a prudential, and we were moved out here, and the resentments that I remember start. I remember being resentful against the Air Force for uprooting me out of the life that I was living, resentful at my father for what had happened, and just angry about it, the whole deal, and not knowing how to express that. If you had known me in school, you would think that I was a relatively well-adjusted, normal kid. I did well in school. I got good grades. I was on the football team. I played sports. I was in high school. I was in just about every club that I could fit into my schedule. You would think that I was relatively well adjusted. But what would happen? As soon as that bell rang, as soon as that bus dropped me off at home, I didn't know you. You didn't know me. We didn't talk. We didn't hang out. I didn't know how to relate to people, on a day-to-day basis. I didn't feel comfortable hanging out with anybody. I didn't, I wasn't good in a crowd. I was the chameleon. I was the guy that was what you wanted me to be. One thing that I always thought was that, being raised in a military family and moving from place to place on a regular basis, I thought it taught me the ability to adapt to a new situation. And as I got sober, what I realized is that it had taught me the ability to lie. Because every time I got to a new place, I tried to be exactly what I thought you wanted me to be. Flew model airplanes, I'd flown a real airplane. If you were into sports cars, I'd driven one. If you were into, whatever you were into, I was into, and probably just a little bit better than you. So that you'd like me. So that you'd allow me into your group. You'd want to be, hang out with me. And I was thinking about the last stop we were at was in Colorado. And I was thinking about the lies that I built over 5 years there, and the stories upon stories upon stories that just got so moshed up, even at 13, it started to get to the point where I couldn't differentiate between the true and the false. You know, the lies have become such a part of my character, you know, that I didn't know what was true anymore. I'm one of those guys that you can wake me up in my own bed at 6 o'clock in the morning and ask me what I'm doing there, and I'll probably lie to you. That's just my nature. I'm a liar, and it's one of those things that I struggled in sobriety to deal with. My wife can ask me what time I went to bed last night, and I will probably lie to her at first. What time did you go? About 11:30, and then the conversation will go on for a minute, and they're like, "Nah, honey, it was closer to 1:30." I don't know why. She doesn't care what time I went to bed. Tonight, perfect example. She was asking me about some mess in the basement, and I'm terrible. I'm pointing my finger at my 2-year-old son. I'm terrible. The difference between it today and then is I instantly admit to it now. And I try to correct it, and my day-to-day prayers is, God, help me to be honest today, because I don't want to be that person, and I actively struggle with that. But, back to the story. Like I said, you didn't know me, we didn't talk, we didn't hang out, and that was fine. I was fine being alone. I was comfortable being alone. I always used to think, that my drinking didn't really take off until I got to college. And as I've grown in sobriety and I've looked back at the past and I've done inventories and I've done, conversations with guys that I sponsor, and book work, I can see where, my alcoholic drinking, was every time I got alone with booze, I drank as much as my body could handle. I was thinking about, I was... In sophomore year, I was hanging out with a friend after school. We went over to his house, and his parents were home, and we drank out as much tequila as I could handle at that point. Lick, slam, suck 6 or 7 shots, and get to that happy place. My next door neighbor across the street, if he could steal some beer from his dad, we'd go underneath the bridge and drink it. My pièce de résistance. I was in France on a trip between my junior and senior year. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and my French teacher found me in the bar with a mountain of beer cans in front of me. And these were all things that I didn't think I actually drank like that till I got to college. These were just kids having fun. And what it was every time I got around booze, there wasn't enough, and that's exactly what it was. I applied to, out of school, I applied to exactly one college. I applied to Roane University in South Jersey. I got into it. I was to be part of their brand new engineering program. And I was excited. And I went down to college with the best intentions. I was going to go down there. I was going to get good grades. I was going to make my parents proud. Everything was going to be great. And it was for about a week. At the end of that first week, the first fraternity house party started. And I found myself in the basement of a fraternity house, camped out next to the keg, drinking absolutely as much booze as my body could handle. Stumbling upstairs, puking my brains out, and heading back downstairs for more. I'm a puker. I won't mix any words. I drink and I throw up and I drink some more. And that's just how it was. There was no such thing as enough. I know I call it a college. It was more like a party with a $15,000 cover charge, now that I think about it. I didn't go to a whole lot of school going on down there. But anyway, so there I am in that fraternity house party, and I'm the guy at the end of the night drinking those half-empty cans and bottles of beer, that are left over because I hadn't had enough. And if you get one with a cigarette butt, you go and that's what happens when you drink like I do. You go upstairs, you throw up, you go back downstairs. I just made room. And that's how I drank. I stumbled back to my dorm room about 2 o'clock in the morning. I prayed to the porcelain goddess for about 30 minutes, and I passed out on the bathroom floor. I woke up the next morning with octagon face. That's the tile imprint you get on the side of your face for sleeping on the bathroom floor. Woke up the next morning with octagon face. Crawled to my bed, passed out on my pile of nice clean clothes, which I never bothered to put away. Too much trouble. And woke up about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, feeling miserable. And not feeling miserable because of the amount I drank the night before. If you threw up like I did, you didn't get a whole lot of hangovers. Feeling miserable because I didn't make it to any classes that day. I knew I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. You know, and I wasn't proud of it. You know, and I'd mope around campus, you know, for the next 4 to 6 hours, maybe get something to eat, you know, hang out with some friends, you know, do whatever. You know, but invariably I knew what would make me feel better. You know, I knew that there was a fraternity house somewhere that night, and I was going to be there. And I went back down to that fraternity house, drank absolutely as much as my body can handle, repeated the whole cycle all over again, you know, until the end of that semester. You know, I was 19. I was not of age. Didn't really hang out with a lot. Like I said, I didn't have a whole lot of friends from high school. Didn't know where the parties were. Didn't know where to drink. You know, and I quickly found out that the guy on the street corner doesn't check ID. It was better living through chemistry. What have you got? You know, because, you know, as I've come to understand my disease of alcoholism has less to do with the alcohol that I drink and more to do with the effect that it produces upon me. You know, and the effect that alcohol has upon me is getting me outside of me. You know, getting me out between my ears, because, you know, when I'm between here, there's a wheel spinning in there, you know, and it's going a million miles a second, and I can't handle that most of the time. You know, it just tears me up. But I know, you know, I have a couple of drinks, and it's a stick that I can shove into that wheel, and it stops. You know, and I know that pot, you know, I know anything, I know plenty of drugs that I can do that is a stick that'll stop that wheel. You know, I'll tell you right now, I've done a lot of different things. Alcohol was my favorite. You know, and I heard it best from Earl Hightower. You know, he said that alcohol was the best because there was quality control. You know, I mean, I did a lot of drugs, but I never knew what I was getting from the guy on the street corner. The U.S. government certified that whiskey was 120 proof. You know, and they, you know, that was, you know, so that, you know, that's why I drank. You know, because I knew exactly what I was going to get. You know, and you know, so, you know, but it was the wheel. It was the stick that stopped that wheel. You know, and you know, so what did I do? Well, you know, so, you know, I come back to New, you know, I come back to North Jersey where I was living, and I get a job, the job that I was going to hold for the next, you know, roughly on and off for the next 10 years. I started working in a kitchen in a butcher shop. My dealer was in the seafood department, and life was great. You know, life was great because I had everything that I needed, you know, and, you know, when I worked and I partied, and I went back down to school that next semester with the best intentions. I was going to do good. I was going to get good grades. Everything was going to be great. And it was for about a week. You know, at the end of that first week, the first fraternity house party started again. I was back off to the races. You know, at the end of that semester, you know, I was on academic probation. The college said that I had to get my grades up or I was going to get kicked out. And I knew something was wrong. I knew my drinking had a part. You know, I knew my drinking and my drugging had something to do with it. You know, and probably for the first time, you know, I knew that I had to do something. I had to do something. And so what I did is I signed up for a sober dormitory. You know, I figured I could go live at the sober dormitory, and because of where I was living, I wouldn't be drinking, I wouldn't be drugging like I was doing, and you know, and everything was going to be great. You know, and then I went back home that summer, and I continued to work, and I continued to do what I was doing, and I went back down to the next semester with the best intentions. You know, everything was going to be good. Everything was going to be great. I was going to get good grades. You know, I was going to make my parents proud. I was staying in the sober dormitory, wasn't going to drink. You know, and all that sober dormitory meant was I didn't sleep there. You know, like my roommate had a single room that whole semester because I didn't stop doing what I was doing. At the end of that semester, you know, I decided college wasn't for me, and I left and I joined the working force. You know, if the college was up here telling you my story, they would say that at the end of that third semester, they kicked me out. But this is my story, and I'm telling it, all right? So, you know, I decided at the end of that third semester, the college wasn't for me, and I went off and I joined the working force, you know, and absolutely nothing changed. You know, nothing changed. You know, all that changed was my routine. You know, in the morning, if I had a little something and I'd do that, you know, a little non-conference approved material, perhaps, or, you know, if I didn't have any of that, it was a shot of whiskey and off to work. You know, I start working and everything be fine, move right along, and then, you know, 11, noon, 1 o'clock, start getting itchy, you know, start getting irritable, you know, start not wanting to be there, and if I had something in the car, I'd go do that. If not, it was off to the go-go bar for a six-pack and a lap dance, and that's a whole other story. You know, I got problems other than alcohol, and that happens to be one of them, you know, You know, so, you know, but that's just the way it was, you know, and I do that and I go back to work and everything be great and I'd be moving right along, everything be fine. You know, the end of work would come along and it was off to the bar or it was off to the house, you know, wherever I had to go. You know, if I was going home, I was going to stop at the liquor store and get myself a fit of whiskey, and I was going to head home. If it was to the bar, it was off to the go-go bar for a night of debauchery, and that's just the way it was. I don't know if this is a Midwestern thing, you know, but at my house, all we had to drink out of were 24 to 32 ounce mason jars. You know, the kind of jars you get, you know, spaghetti sauce in. You know, I don't know if my parents were cheap or what, but this is all we had to drink out of. So it was a couple of chunks of ice, about 3/4 of the way with whiskey, and a little bit of diet vanilla Pepsi because I want to be healthy, and knock back as many of those as it took for me to go to sleep that night. I called it going to sleep. It was passing out. Now, at this point, it was maintenance drinking. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't drinking so much that I throw up. I was just drinking enough to get into that comfortable place. And I do that, and I repeat the whole cycle all over again. You know, next morning, get out of bed and do the whole thing all over again. You know, along the way, I'm a criminal, and I'm a bad one, because I always get caught. Along the way, I start getting, arrests for possession. I get the DWI on my ride into work one morning. I just run into the law. And every single time I got arrested and I go on probation, my father would make a very interesting remark. He said, "Ryan, just because you can't smoke pot doesn't mean you can drink twice as much." And I didn't see that, but that's exactly what was going on. You know, anytime I didn't have anything to supplement my drinking, I just had to supplement my drinking with more drinking. Because I had to do more to get to the same place. And that's just the way it went. You know, it was never a fact. You know, if I ever got arrested, it wasn't because I was doing something illegal. It was because I was doing something illegal the wrong way. If I wasn't smoking that joint on the right end of work, they would have never seen me, pulled me over, and given me that, possession charge. If I wasn't stumbling down the middle of the street in the middle of the night, hammered, I wouldn't have got that drunk and disorderly. It was never, it was always just a bad situation that it had nothing to do with me. It was just, poor planning. So I always figured if I planned better, I could get away with it. And every time I tried that, I got the same results. I had met a young woman at this point, and she's my wife today. And she was great. She was one of those people that she could party with the best of them, but she could put it down. She was the kind of woman, who'd buy a pack of cigarettes, smoke four out of them, and let the rest go stale. At the time I just kind of brushed it off, but today I've got no concept of that. There's a bottle, I'll tell you right now, there's a bottle of wine in my fridge, and it's probably been there for like a month. She pours herself a half a glass of wine, she has it, and then she puts it away. I don't get that. I've got no problem with it. Guys that I sponsor, how do you deal with that? I'm like, I don't. That's her deal. I deal with it by going to AA and knowing that I'm in the right place and the right spiritual frame of mind, that I don't have to worry about her drinking. Her drinking ain't even drinking. But she could party with the best of them, and it was love at first sight. The first night we got together and she breaks out the bottle of Boone's Farm, I knew it was love. It was perfect. She was a cheap date. It was great. Don't tell her I said that. This is being recorded, right? Yeah. Right. But anyway, so over time, she doesn't want to put up with this anymore. Where was I heading with that? One fine December morning, about 2002, I was rudely awakened by the Denville Police, the Morris County Sheriff's Office, Morris County Prosecutor's Office, and any other local law enforcement agency that happened to be handy, as they knocked down my parents' door and arrested everybody in the house. I was led down from my upstairs bedroom in my underwear, and there was my mother, my father, my twin brother, his girlfriend, my older brother, and my girlfriend in the living room in handcuffs. What had been going on was, if you were going to go-go bars and doing the drugs I was doing and drinking the booze that I was drinking, you ran short on cash. So I thought it was a good idea to start selling weed out of my parents' garage. And somewhere along the line, somebody had decided to turn on me and you know, tell the cops what was going on, and here they come. And they bring me down to the police station, and they put the lights on me. And I don't know if you guys have ever seen the movie Goonies. I'm a little bit like Chunk from the Goonies. They put the lights on me, and I'm telling them every dirty little thing I did when I was 3 years old. When I was 3, I killed a kitten. When I was 5, I set fire to a small patch of forest. When I was 6, I'm telling them every single dirty thing I did, little thing I ever did. I'm writing it all down on paper. I'm signing my name on the bottom line, and they got me dead to rights for selling drugs out of my parents' house. And I obtained the services of a lawyer. I get the discovery about a month later, and in that discovery, I was mentioned exactly once as being present at a drug deal that my older brother was conducting. And I got another big resentment, because if he hadn't been doing that, then I wouldn't have gotten in trouble. It had nothing to do with what I was doing, and it had everything to do with what he was doing, and it was all his fault. And needless to say, my drinking didn't stop at that point. What had happened, though, as a result of that, is I got put into what was called a task evaluation, which you sit down with this evaluator, and probably for the second time in my life, I was entirely honest with somebody and told them what I was doing, how often I was doing it, and how much I was doing. And they said, "Ryan, you need help. You need drug and alcohol counseling. And here's the guy you're going to go see." And this guy, a doctor by the name of Gary Schneider, who I believe to be a master of ego deflation, beat me down to the size where I would fit through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm driving home, April of 2003, I'm crying my eyes out, I'm trying to decide whether or not to drive into a bridge above me. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't drink, I couldn't drug, and I couldn't live without either of those things. And I had one of those cathartic moments where it was just like, what the hell am I going to do? And what I did is I called a man I had met several years earlier who had identified himself to me as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know what he saw, but he felt it necessary to break his anonymity and said, if I ever needed any help, call him. And I kept in touch with him on and off, but he was the first person I thought of that night. And I called him and I asked him what I should do. He said, "Ryan, if you think, there's a meeting tomorrow night, do you think you cannot drink and make it to the meeting tomorrow night?" And I said, "I can do that, Dave. I'll see you tomorrow night." And I went home and I drank all the whiskey I had left in the house. I'm an alcoholic. If I don't have a solution for my problem, I'm going to go back to the only solution that I know. And at T-minus 1 day sober, I have no solution. So I go back. I drink all the whiskey I had left in the house, and I go to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that next night. That was April 14th, 2002. And he handed me a big book and a 12 and 12, and he said, "Read these and ask me any questions you have." And I don't know about you, but I don't like asking people questions. I don't like looking stupid. I don't like looking like I don't know what's going on. What I do is I don't read them, and I float around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 2 months like an alkanaut. All I do is I sit there and listen, and I hear a lot of good things. June of that year, I'm supposed to be at in the bridal party at a wedding in Maryland. And I ask everybody, I don't know what to do. I don't want to drink. I don't know how to do this. And they give me a lot of good advice. They give me a pocket, 12 and 12. They say, put this in your back pocket. You sit at the bar. You think about maybe you shouldn't take that drink. When you get down there, find a meeting, call your sponsor, and whatever you do, don't go to the bachelor party. And I get down the first night, and I'm at the bachelor party, and I'm white knuckling it, because I can do this, right? I can do this. I can be at the bachelor party, and everything will be okay. And I'm white knuckling it, and I'm white knuckling it, and I'm white knuckling it, and I make it about 3/4 of the way through the night. And all the time, my friends say, "Hey, man, you can take a drink. You weren't an alcoholic. Drugs were your problem. You can have a drink." And what do I do? I go outside, I call my sponsor, I tell him everything's great, I go to the bar, I order a short shot and a beer. Because that's the kind of guy I am. And I get that shot and a beer in me, and I have another round, and these guys are like, "Okay, it's time to go." I had heard enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to know exactly the feeling I had at that moment. And that feeling was a phenomenon of craving. You know, and I didn't know before this ever happened. I didn't know if that's what this was, but what had happened was I had had that alcohol, and that was, you know, I don't know about you, but the pump was running dry. I needed more. You know, I'm trying to tell these guys to stop every single place in between here and wherever the heck we were to where we're going, and I'm like, no, just stop here. Can you get something here? Can you stop here? And they didn't stop that night. And I went home and went to bed frustrated that night. I'll tell you, 11 o'clock the next morning, I'm in the liquor store, I'm getting a six pack of beer and a fifth of Jameson whiskey, you know, and I'm drinking all that day. You know, I end up that night drinking a German liquor called Ratzeputz. Sounds about as good as it tastes, but it was 120 proof, and that's all that mattered. You know, and I'm drinking that, and I end up that night the same way I end up my nights when I'm drinking heavy. I'm puking my brains out, waking up the next morning with an octagon face. It's about 11:30 in the morning. The wedding's at noon. I haven't showered. I haven't shaved. I reek of puke, sweat, booze, and cigarettes. And I got to be in this bridal party. You know, and I'm standing up in front of the room, and I feel like a royal POS. And you know, and I had another beer that day just to take the edge off. You know, and I come back to AA in northern New Jersey with my tail between my legs, and I finally consent to a guy who would not leave me alone. This guy, every single meeting he saw me, would ask me, "Hey, Ryan, you want to go through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I was like, "Yeah, Frank, next week, we'll do that." You know, and every single time I saw him, this guy was like, "You want to go through the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And finally, you know, I was beat to the point of reasonableness. You know, that I said yes. When do you want to meet? You know, we sat down and we started going through the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we worked the steps as we came to them. We got up to the third step, we hit our knees together, and I thought it appropriate at that point to ask him to be my sponsor, and he started to be my sponsor, and you know, and I miss Frank. You know, Frank Weston was a pillar in our community in northern New Jersey, and he passed away last May. And and if it weren't for Frank, you'd have a different speaker here tonight, because you know, he showed me the way to do this deal, you know, and live a happy, productive life. He showed me that I need to drive an hour and 15 minutes, if that's what I'm asked to do, to go speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because that's what I need to do. There is no such thing as out of the way for a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that served me well, you know, from the day he told me that to today. You know, but we went, and I said, we worked the steps as we went along through them, you know, and we got up to step five, and when I acquainted himself with me, you know, and he wasn't impressed, my deep dark secrets weren't as bad as I thought they were, you know, and we started writing up that list for the eighth step, and then I started off going to make an amends, you know, and I started practicing those principles in my life on a daily basis, and I don't know if you guys noticed, but I did. You know, somewhere along the way, you know, I traded step six and seven, exactly as they are in the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, three paragraphs, you know, and they weren't applying to my life on a daily basis. And I thought that I could go to the go-go bar and get a lap dance and drink soda and everything would be fine, you know, and I got away with that for about 6 months, you know, and then one Wednesday night, I'm driving down there, you know, and I know I'm not doing the right thing, and I know I'm going to drink that night. And I was powerless over alcohol. I knew I'm driving down there. I know exactly where there's a meeting. Wednesday night, 8 o'clock. You know, it's 5 minutes from where I am. You know, I don't have to worry. I got my sponsor's phone number memorized. I'm sponsoring four guys. You know, I got people I can call. I got a network. And there was absolutely nothing that was going to stop me from getting that drink that night. You know, and that's what I did. You know, and I drank for about a week. And if you guys want to have a lot of fun, drink and go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings drunk. Well, or at least half lit. It's a blast. Especially in meetings like this where you know a lot of people. You've been coming for a year and 3 months. Everybody knows you. You know, and they're all like, "Ryan, are you okay? You don't look so good." And I'm like, I'm fine. It's a little head cold. You know, it doesn't feel so good. You know, and for four meetings I did that. And tried to tell myself that I could get away with it, and just suffering. You know, just suffering in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, finally that night, that October 1st, I talked to my sponsor and I told him what was going on. And we got back into the book and we looked exactly what had been going on. And what had been going on was my sexual inventory and the fifth step wasn't complete. And six and seven were not active parts of my life. I'll tell you today that six and seven are probably the most important steps that I use on a daily basis in my life to stay sober. You know, because my drinking doesn't start with the thought of a drink. You know, my drinking starts with my poor behavior when I'm letting my character defects run my life. You know, and then eventually the pain becomes great enough that the only solution I know to quench that pain becomes the booze again if I don't do something about it. Now, in 6 and 7 is the way that I do that, because I can't effectively do steps 10 and 11 without 6 and 7. Now, and so that's exactly when we hit 6 and 7 hard. We got back into the steps, and today go-go bars are no longer a problem. Because I remind myself on a daily basis what I need to do. Those four guys that I was sponsoring, of those four guys, all of them are still sober. I went to my sponsor and said, "What the heck am I supposed to do?" And he said, "What you're supposed to do is you're supposed to direct them in the direction of a man who can help them, because you no longer can." I found we talked and we found guys that they could, I made sure they weren't hanging out with that without sponsorship, because a guy who sponsors himself has an idiot for a sponsor. I can speak to that in experience. Because when Frank passed away that May, I hung out in Alcoholics Anonymous without a sponsor, and I had a lot of stupid ideas, about who should sponsor me and how I should run my program, and I paid for it. It was pointed out to me that, that every time a door closes, this old, cliche, every time, a door closes, God opens a window, or he opens another door, he gives us some other route. And it was also pointed to me that the only thing that makes a difference is how long you stand in the hallway. And that hit me like a ton of bricks, because I was standing in the hallway of Alcoholics Anonymous not doing anything. I might have been sponsoring guys, but my sponsorship was less than adequate. I might have been going to meetings, but my attendance was not there. I was wrapped up in my own guilt, my own self-pity, my own fears, and I needed somebody to talk to about that, because if I didn't, those little problems were going to pile up on me and become astonishingly difficult to solve, just like if I was coming in the doors for the first time. That's what I did. Frank had taken care of me. He knew he was going. Everybody knew Frank was going. It was not a sudden thing. And he took care of me. He said, "Talk to Jim. Keep in touch with Jim. Talk to Dana." He was giving me directions to get me in the direction of new sponsorship, because he knew he wasn't going to be hanging out for very long. I can only hope to have that much grace in Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm on my deathbed, being more worried about my sponsees, that they're going to stay sober after I'm gone, than to be worrying about me. And that's the kind of man Frank was. He always used to say, "It's a really neat deal." And that's exactly what it was. After about a month of standing in the hallway, I asked a gentleman to be my sponsor, one of my brother pigeons, a gentleman by the name of Dana, and we immediately got back into the work. Now, like I said, I sponsor about seven guys right now, four of which are actively involved in sponsorship, three of which are banging their heads on a wall somewhere. I need those guys. I need those guys because those are the guys that I get to pay the most attention to. The four guys that are actively involved in sponsoring guys or have actively involved in step work, our phone calls last about a minute. "Hey, how you doing? Everything good?" "Good. How are the guys you're sponsoring?" "Great. All right, moving right along." Okay, then Danny calls. All right, and then Danny's the guy who's banging his head on the wall. And he's got so many problems that I have none. That is the greatest deal of Alcoholics Anonymous. That when I sponsor guys, I have no problems. Because I'm more worried about them than I am about myself. I'm more concerned with their problems than I am about my own. And that keeps me outside of me. When I drank for the 12 promises of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I drank, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. When I drank, I intuitively knew how to handle situations with Vaseline. I got sober for the 12 promises of Alcoholics Anonymous and the scores of other promises that are in the book. Today I know a new freedom and a new happiness, and I don't have to use a drug or alcohol to get there. Today I intuitively know how to handle situations with use of Vaseline. My intuition may not be perfect at times. It tells me in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I may pay for that presumption. But I have a program of action that allows me to get right back on track when I do. Like I said, my home group, which we meet on Thursdays and Sundays, is the centerpiece of my sobriety. as far as where I'm active and where I do my work. I'm also very active in service. I had the opportunity today to be active in our district, go to area assemblies, and be participating in the Freedom Facilities Committee. Right now we're getting ready to, hosting a GSR and a DCM workshop in our district, and I'm on the ad hoc committee for planning that event, finding a location. I get the opportunity today to do a lot of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not half the work that I think it's going to be. Now, I was talking to a guy the other night, because we got Night Watch coming up here in a couple of weeks. And Night Watch, if you don't know, is the intergroup allows the groups an opportunity to answer the phones for them at night. So if an alcoholic calls, there's somebody there to pick up the phone. And I got that coming up on a Thursday night, coming up pretty soon. And one of the guys that I'm sponsoring, relatively new in sobriety, says, how do you do that? How can you stay up all night, answer these phone calls, and still get up for work the next day? And I said, first off, I don't stay up all night. I got sober, not stupid. I go to bed, the phone rings, I get up, I go answer it. As simple as that. But second, even if they do keep me up all night, there's never been a time in Alcoholics Anonymous that if I was actively involved in step work, actively involved in the 12-step, intergroup, whatever, that God hasn't taken care of me the next day. Now, I can tell you the number of times that I've been in an emergency room with a wet drunk trying to get him into detox. It's 3:00 in the morning, and I'm dreading the next day, thinking, how am I going to get through the next day? And I wake up that morning, and I'm refreshed, I'm energized, and my spirit is alive. And that's God taking care of me. I'm one of those guys that honestly believe today that God's going to give me everything I need to get through the day. Doesn't say He's going to make it easy on me. The old cliche is God's not going to give me anything that you can't handle. I don't believe that. God's not going to give me anything that I can't handle with Him. It's going to be more than I can handle some days. But that's when I need to turn to God and say, hey, I need some help. Because I can't do this alone. And I don't think any of us can. Now, every single morning I hit my knees, I ask God to direct my thoughts and actions through the day. During the day, when I get bunched up and I get pissed off, which I do quite often, I deal in customer service, I work outside, it's hot. It gets hot, I get hot. I got to find a place I can hit my knees and ask God just to cool me down a little bit. And He does. I find that quiet place where I can reflect a little bit on the day, try to figure out where I'm heading the wrong direction and see what I can do to correct it. At the end of the day, I hit my knees again, and I thank God for the day. I thank Him for everything He's given me, everything He's taken away, and everything I've lost. Because it's everything I have today is a direct result of the actions I learned to take in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife, who I married 3 years ago, was ready to leave me when I got sober. When I got sober, I kicked her out of the house. Because when I first got sober, it was more important for me to stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't do both. And she understood that at the beginning. I said, just honey, give me a couple of months. All right, I can't have you here and be trying to go to 7 meetings a week, working with my sponsor 3 nights a week, trying to get my head screwed on straight because I'm not right for you right now and you're not right for me and I need to do this. And today she was my wife. That woman read my 4-step. I don't recommend that. All right, anybody got any ideas? Not a good idea. All right? But she read my 4-step, and because I had a sponsor in my life at the time who I could talk to, I was able to get some direction and get catapulted into the 9-step, and going to make amends to her. And today we got a beautiful 2-year-old boy, who if I was drinking, I could not be a father. I could not be a father. I couldn't even take care of myself. And I know today that, if I had been kept drinking, I probably wouldn't be alive today. Because the way I was going and the behaviors I was doing, I was heading off a cliff. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. More importantly, I love what it does for those people in my life. Amber talked about family. It's given me a family back. More importantly, it's given me a whole new family. Anytime I travel in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know I'm going to an AA meeting, and I'm going to feel at home. I got people in my life today who care about me, and I care about them, and that's more than I ever had before. And I couldn't have done without you guys. Thanks very much for letting me share.